Next case is 99683 Lawrence Hester versus Lila Wivetti.
Probably isn't. That's why you heard that was answer the tough questions. You know who wrote that?
Told you.
He did. The state adapted this from my Toledo ordinance that I wrote.
You see?
But I said, and let me see which I'm in. And they changed it.
Since you done this, because this is New Lynch Court. My name is John Bullshot. We'd like to serve 3 minutes before we vote. The issue before this court is a relatively straightforward issue. A simple one, but it's straightforward. We're a physician is caring for a woman during her pregnancy. And where that physician, during the course of the pregnancy, performed a test that revealed the penis, in all probability, has birth defects. Where that physician fails, negligently fails to inform the patient of the result of that test and the probability of birth defects, such that the child, the pregnancy then continues, and the child is born with birth defect, in this case, hypogenitive. And again, where the testimony and the evidence should be that had the parent been advised of the birth defect, the pregnancy would have been terminated. Furthermore, where the physician is aware that based on that test, extraordinary expenses will be incurred if that child is born. Extraordinary expenses in terms of education, in terms of training, in terms of care. And where the law in Ohio recognizes the parents' cause of action to recover those extraordinary expenses, then the issue is we take that one step farther and allow that child, when the child reaches the age of majority, to recover those same extraordinary expenses the law now allows the parents to recover.
Because that's really what you're asking for. You're asking for after the child becomes, by law, emancipated, the damages or the amount that it's going to take extra to take care of that child in the child's adult stage of life.
Exactly.
And it makes it a completely different case than I wrote Johnson for the court before, and it was a tough decision. Some of those were tough decisions when we went through them, and the following one too, I guess, against the preterm clinic on the abortion question. Those were asking for damages for the parents. Yours is just for the child post-emancipation.
Correct.
But the only way that the damages here could be avoided was for the child to be aborted.
That's right. Correct.
You know, doctor, there's no question, as I read the briefs, no question the doctor here, there's no malpractice issue. The doctor just simply did not, unless not advising the parents of the condition of the fetus is malpractice, but in terms of medical terms, there certainly was no malpractice. So it's the damages here arise from the fact if the fetus had been aborted, there'd be no damages, I guess. Do you agree?
Yes, no extraordinary expenses.
No extraordinary expenses. And so the argument is that the baby was born and it's spina bifida, and the parents are candidly saying if we'd known the wife was carrying a spina bifida baby, we would have it aborted.
Exactly right.
So that's the issue.
And that's exactly why that has to
be. Does somebody pay for it? Does a doctor, in effect, pay for not telling the parents that you have a spina bifida baby so you can abort it?
Exactly. And that reason the test was performed during the course of the pregnancy, why this is called amniocentesis, where they take the amniotic fluid, sample amniotic fluid, and they analyze it to see if there's a high level of this, what is called alpha fetal protein, AFP. And if there is this high level of AFP, that is highly suggestive the child may have spina bifida. That is the sole reason, the major reason why that test was performed in this case.
Is this test performed routinely in your pregnancy?
No, Your Honor, it's not routine, although my understanding is that when the parents, after age 35, it is routinely at that point recommended, although it is strictly a discretionary matter of the parents.
Okay, and this case has not progressed to the point that we
through her deposition, having testified that had she been advised of the result of this test and that they were abnormal, they would have aborted. This was, by way of background, a second marriage for both parents. They were 39 years old. Patricia Esper was 39, and Lawrence Esper was older than that. And they had made the decision that they, after, it was not a planned pregnancy, but when they found out Patricia was pregnant, they had determined that if that pregnancy would go on and they had this test and the test came back normal, they would continue the pregnancy. That again, is at that age, the reason they had that test is for personal reasons. If that child was going to have significant birth defects, they had made that personal decision to terminate the pregnancy.
That's the only reason you had that particular test. There are two of them that you do at the end. Synthesis is always done for that reason. Now, do we have any idea why the doctor didn't convey that? I mean, it would never have occurred to me, you know, I had it done in my family, and you do it to go ask, what does it show?
Right. Exactly.
Did she ask, or did he not tell, or why?
That occurred in this case, and Patricia Esper testified that when she asked the physician what were the results of the test, that the report came back, they were wrong. There were actually, it's interesting, Your Honor.
But both doctors knew that it was abnormal.
That's correct.
That's been suggested by a statement here this morning that not telling the parents or mistelling the parents is not malpractice. Do you agree with that?
No, I was going to. Chief Justice raised that.
I think I clarified by saying medical malpractice in the sense of some procedure was done improperly. I recognize the argument that, you know, he didn't advise the patient as he should have. That could be malpractice in the larger sense of the term. But I meant he didn't cause the deficiency or the deformity of the baby as well.
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
That's exactly right.
But he caused a decision not to abort.
That's exactly right.
So isn't that malpractice?
That's exactly right.
Well, it's just the difference between an act
or
of
negligence.
Omission and commission.
Yeah.
So the report actually showed that there was something wrong.
And the doctor didn't have to be asked in order to walk the mother. In fact, it's five months.
And
so
she assumed that
everything was good. In this case, we don't know whether that was the evidence is not felt, we don't know whether or not that was a mistake on the part of the doctor or whether the doctor was morally opposed to abortion. Premature to even judge whether or not there should be an opportunity to seek recovery of damage.
I didn't mean to step on
your
toe.
If you don't know, was this just an inadvertence?
I was confused.
Managed to fail to tell that they practiced together? No. But the scenario, Your Honor, is that Dr. DeVitti was the obstetrician. She did not perform amniocentesis. In fact, she referred mom over to Dr. Salhan, who did the amniocentesis. There has been testimony from both Lawrence Esper and Patricia Esper. But Patricia Esper checked with the obstetrician, Dr. Beattie. Lawrence Esper checked with Dr. Salhan. And both independently were told they were fine. They were never advised about those risks. To answer Your Honor's question, no, the issue is not premature. Because this is a legal issue regarding whether, again, the infant child born with these birth defects and who will incur these extraordinary expenses has a claim and a cause of action.
And it's the same claim, the same cause of action, whether the doctors didn't inform through inadvertence or innocent mistake. Or whether they didn't inform intentionally because they had a deep moral or body conviction against
still the same cause of action. Same facts, but their motivation for not, for negligence or intentional, at this point, is not in development.
And this cause of action is created for the child, which is the majority, would be separate and distinct from the parents. By that, I mean that it would not be a duplication of benefits of being the parents.
Absolutely not, because the way the planning court recognized and held that under a first identical situation for older adults, the parents do have a cause of action before. And cited the majority of jurisdictions in this country recognize that situation. So they refuse to take the next step. In fact, for this being said, this is where the decision belongs, which is the law of this court, is whether that child on reaching age majority has a cause of action. And I submit to the court that it really comes down to an issue of foreseeability. As Justice Douglas wrote in the Johnson case, and also concurred in the Anderson case, the issue comes with the issue of proximate cause and foreseeability. And is it foreseeable by a physician in negligently failing to advise the parents of these birth defects that these extraordinary expenses will be incurred? Is that foreseeable to the physician? And I submit clearly the answer is yes. That is the reason that Justice Douglas pointed out.
Foreseeability, and the problem I'm struggling with this case is the foreseeability only happens if the child lives. And so basically what we would be doing is saying, you get damages because this child had life. You don't get damages if this child has no life. And so how is that different from wrongful life, which we have already said is not compensable?
Because Your Honor, you bring out an excellent point. If the child has not been born, Your Honor stated, there are no damages. So the harsh reality of the situation is that child was born, and that child was born with these birth defects that will incur. We're not asking, and this is like a wrong distinction, Your Honor, this is not a true, quote, wrongful life. In a wrongful life case, this court is defined is the birth of a healthy, normal child. That's how this court is defined wrongful life. And if this court is held in Johnson, the only compensable damages are the pregnancy, because it's not foreseeable that there will be extraordinary damages beyond that, and the joy of raising a healthy child is offset or expected or offset by the joy.
What message does that send that your decision to have a child is one that carries damages, carries penalties, carries a price? What message does that send if we award damages for the fact that the child lived?
Here,
the child has a penalty.
It is only, we are not seeking general damages. We are seeking only the extraordinary damages that this child will be saddled with and burdened with the rest of the child's life. Was that foreseeable? I go back, Your Honor, it is basic part of the court law. Was there a duty owed to the child? Yes. The duty, was the child been aborted? Had this been resolved or reported? Yes.
So foreseeability exists in the wrongful life, in wrongful life action as well. So
yes.
Foreseeability is the person, in the case that we had, in that case that we had, the person lived but had extraordinary medical expenses, but we still didn't do it again.
But Your Honor, the distinction in that case was a sterilization procedure. And it was not foreseeable.
I'm not talking about the case where the family was
that was Anderson.
Anderson. That was the distinction, again, that was a wrongful living case, I think is how this court defined it. That was a continued life. And the issue, and it was not foreseeable, the court said, yes, perhaps the issue.
What's the difference between a continued life and a forever life? There's still a life.
You're right. But the issue, Your Honor, is whether that the damages that we are seeking, the extraordinary damages, were foreseeable to make that issue a proximate cause. This court in Anderson said no, that they were not foreseeable. Yes, possibly down the road this man may have a stroke, but we're not going to go that far. In this case, the sole purpose for the alpha-fetal protein test being performed on this mother was to look for those birth defects. And that negligence, the failure report, led to this child being burdened with extraordinary expenses for the rest of the child's life. And submit to your honor that under basic tort law, this duty, a breach of duty, it was foreseeable, and therefore the defendant is responsible in this case for this extraordinary.
I have another question going to damages. When the damages are determined for the parent, is the entire life of the child considered?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question. And it becomes a matter of whether the child will be emancipated at age 18. And that goes back to why this is important. If the child is not emancipated at 18, all of the costs for that child's life would be recoverable under the current status of the law. Where does this distinction occur, or what rationale would lie that when the child turns 18, and if that child becomes emancipated, the damage would be cut off?
Would you give the parents?
It makes no sense. So the continuation of the damages by the premise of the child finding team would become You're absolutely right.
Not the law of this court.
You're right.
So really, to reach your issue, you have to
No, that issue is not before this court. In the Court of Appeals, it was acknowledged by all counsel in the Court of Appeals that that is the current law, and you're right.
Counsel, your lights on the follow-up on this. Would those cases be tried together? The Justice President is headed toward the issue of double recovery.
Can they come back in 30 years?
So, with those cases, the right to recovery is recognized and said, you can always have to be tried together in order to avoid the possibility of recovery.
And we tried it again. In this case, they were brought together, both plans were brought together, and under the understanding, yes, they would be tried together. I can see a scenario there where, it's a good point, Your Honor, where the parents can bring their claim and wait until the current law, the leash of the child turns 18, she would have a year to file her claim. And it could be two separate cases. However, we have brought them as one and certainly anticipated it would be tried together.
Thank you, Mr. Wiltshire. Ms. Combs.
Expenses. And one part of the appeal in this case deals with pain and suffering. So the limitation as far as what the appellants are requesting is not simply extraordinary expenses, as has been presented in the briefs, but also includes pain and suffering in this case, which goes directly to the issue that Justice Stratton raised with regard to recognition of a cause of action for wrongful life. This court has not previously recognized a cause of action for wrongful life, and we submit that this court should not recognize a cause of action for wrongful life at this point in time based upon this case. The vast majority of jurisdictions across the country have chosen not to recognize such a cause of action, not to make a decision regarding the sanctity of life, not to delve into that type of public policy or philosophical
issue. Counsel, what if there is no recognition, what should be the consequences for a physician who performs a critical test such as this and then gives the wrong information to the family involved?
The consequences run directly to the parent's claim. The duty runs to the parent. The negligence is directed towards the parent, and the proximate cause is directed towards the parent. In this case, there is a total, as far as the child's claim, independent of the parent's claim, there's a total lack of proximate cause between that child's claim and the alleged negligence of the physician, because the only thing the child can claim in impaired life, and the impaired part of it is because of the genetic defect that the doctor had nothing to do with and pre-existed the negligence, or no life at all. So we are looking looking at, in essence, a wrongful life claim. The only thing we have to weigh as far as the child's independent cause of action is life impaired versus no life in making a judgment.
Is there established law already on the issue of, say, an automobile accident that occurs while a woman is pregnant and the fetus is in some way damaged, child still born that has recognizable lifetime injury as a result of that? Is there established law on that, and how is that claim brought?
That scenario is very different, Your Honor, and the reason it's different is because that child had the opportunity to hold it. It was the automobile accident, the injury sustained from the automobile accident that took that away from the child. In this case, there is nothing to take away from this child except life.
In that case, the child could ultimately bring its own cause of action.
You're right, and he said yes.
Was Flanagan ever appealed?
No. Not beyond the appellate. So it is set there. But it's still
a jurisdiction of Flanagan's
township? No, it wasn't. I believe it was
fourth. It's the fourth district.
Fourth, I'm sorry.
Is there any other appellate decision in Ohio to hold in Flanagan?
There is not at this point in time. There have been other appellate courts that have looked at the issue of wrongful pregnancy and Simmons and similar, but no other case has been as close to this as Flanagan was as far as this issue.
You make the point that there's a causal break between the doctor and the child here, break in causation. If this had been the parent's suit, and you were defending that, would you not be here arguing Johnson as the law?
I might be.
Sure. So, in fact, when you say this shouldn't be for the child, it's the parent's claim. We don't really have a parent's claim at this point for wrongful life. Isn't that why this is not a wrongful life case?
Well, I think the parent's claim actually would probably be a wrongful birth claim if we wanted to put it in the terminology that seems to have developed around the law in that regard, because the wrongful birth claim, I believe, is in essence a parent's claim for the fact that the child has been born.
So Johnson would be a wrongful birth claim.
Johnson, I think, was termed a wrongful pregnancy claim because the damages were limited to...
Because I didn't know what else to call it at that time.
But I think that was the way it was termed. But the Johnson decision also did discuss wrongful birth and wrongful life and the definitions thereof. And I think the law developed afterwards with regard to whether you call it wrongful birth or wrongful pregnancy.
Okay, so it's at least wrongful birth or wrongful pregnancy or something like that in Johnson. Anderson would be wrongful life?
Anderson was termed wrongful living, and it's probably as close as you get to wrongful life, and I would say most likely it would be commensurate with wrongful life.
Okay, and we don't have that here.
We don't have...
In this case, we don't have a strict wrongful life case, do we? Because that was, like, if Anderson is a wrongful life, that was the preservation of a life.
That's true. As far as the definition of wrongful life is concerned, it would probably, in my opinion, it would be stretching that definition to include it with Anderson. It was called wrongful living, but if we take a look at the courts in other jurisdictions across the country, the definition of wrongful life absolutely encompasses what the court is evaluating today.
Maybe our problem is that we're getting caught up in the terminology. Maybe this is just a straight negligence case. The doctor said, here's the test, it's okay, and it wasn't. Straight negligence, and the damages that flow are foreseeable to both the parents and the child.
Well, Your Honor, the straight negligence claim that I would submit, there's a lack of causation between the negligence and the injury to the child, and I would submit again that there's a huge struggle in determining that, in fact, there may be a cause of action for life, because that's, in essence, what this court is being asked to decide. If there's a determination that this child has a cause of action for pain and suffering and extraordinary expenses related to that child's life, then you're creating an expectation that every child has a right to be born perfect.
Well, No. No, because you don't, but you don't have the additional factor that there was a knowledge that the child was not going to be born perfect.
There is that knowledge.
In this case, there's that knowledge.
And that, but by the same token, that can be true in any case. Perhaps the parents would choose, because they want a child so desperately, to have a child.
Well, that's, then there's a waiver or something. Then there's a waiver or something that we could call that. Here it's the exact opposite. I mean, you know, we all know, we've been through it. You perform these tests for a specific reason. And the reason is to determine not only the viability of the child, but the condition of the fetus.
And that's true.
And when it comes back that the fetus is damaged to some extent. I had one where it was determined the fetus was blind. The child was blind. And one be with that DES drug, one limb. Does the parent have a right to make that decision?
Under those circumstances, the negligence, if there is negligence and failure to advise, goes to the parents. The parents have a duty to know. The child in utero does not have a duty to make a choice.
The parents tried to find out here. They tried. They did everything they could to find out.
Well, actually,
and then they were misled. They were told no.
We're here on the pleadings, though.
Sure, I understand.
So I'm not going to argue with Mr. Holshue as to what the facts are and whether the parents were advised or weren't, what they knew and what they wanted to know, because that's really not
mm-hmm.
a part of what we're here for.
I understand.
And I would dispute some of what Mr. Holshue represented.
Some of the difficulty in this is that the child is still a minor, and we don't know what the child would say about all this when the child reaches 18 or 21, whatever age you want to pick for when a child can make this sort of decision. Isn't that, I didn't ask Mr. Holt, I guess both of them to sign this brief rebuttal, but isn't that part of the problem is that, where, as you said, this is a claim by the parents, because the parents, it was the parents to whom the misrepresentation or the lack of knowledge was affected. We don't know what the child may, when the child reaches age where a child can speak for himself, say, I'm happy to be alive. I'd rather be alive than not ever been born. So then what are the damages, I guess?
Then you have an issue. And the other question is, should we allow someone to be able to make a claim based on that and say, oh, that was dead? I believe the father is really pointed.
Mr. Lyon.
That's my question. I mean, if we take the parents out of it, because this isn't their case, we have to say under negligence, duty, breach, obviously foreseeability, proximate cause, damages. So from the perspective of the plaintiff, whom we must consider the child, the duty the doctor owed to that child that was breached, essentially it's a duty to abort.
The duty to the doctor, Dr. Saldana, my client, was to report accurately.
Not to the child. The child didn't have that relationship.
The duty of the doctor was to conform to the standard of care for obstetrician. That was to report accurately.
To the parents.
To the parents.
Correct.
He didn't do that. Let's assume. He didn't do it. He was negligent.
So, but let's just talk. We know that. Let's just talk about the child. I'm trying to sort it out. If we keep the parent out of it and think about it in terms of the child, the fetus, I think when you boil it down, we'd have to be saying the duty of a physician to a defective and child impaired by a genetic defect is to, you know, obviously the physician can only deal with the parent. But when the child later brings a complaint, it was the duty to abort. From a child's perspective, what else is it? Because the child didn't have anything to do with the test, only the folk.
Well, if you, by analogy, if you have an obstetrical birth asphyxia case, the duty of the physician is to manage that
right.
birth in a way to not to avoid injury. Fetal monitor strips show a problem.
Standard of care.
And the intervention in a timely fashion avoids damage. What would have avoided the damage to this child? One and only one thing, death.
Termination.
There is no way around it.
That's the same point. I'm thinking that's the way we must think about this.
You have to, because and then you have to say to yourself, someone asked the question, what would the child say if the child were here? The child would be saying to you, I would rather be dead. Now, my point is that we would be creating a cause of action. Because this is a motion that the procedural postures, this is on the pleadings. In other words, the dismissal was that there's no cause of action because it is so contrary to our philosophical principles in this country, in the state of Ohio, to allow a cause of action for by saying that being born is a bad thing. It just doesn't even make sense. But this is a medical malpractice case. And by the way, this is not a contract lying between mom and my doctor saying, the doctor, I want you to know something, that you do this amniocentesis and together we're going to abort this if it comes back bad. That's how this case is. This is a medical malpractice case. This says that if I had known about the amniocentesis, I would have terminated this child. That's the only thing that would have prevented this congenital genetic defect. The doctor had nothing to do. Now, it strikes a very harsh chord in all of us when we say, what's the consequence to the doctor who's made a mistake? We have cases all the time where doctors make mistakes. I just tried a case a couple of weeks ago where three doctors made terrible mistakes. There was no causal relationship between their mistakes and death. Not whatsoever. This is no different than if we were having a separate malpractice case, an obstetrical brain damage case, where it was unequivocally demonstrated that the defect was congenital, it arose at conception, and the failure to intervene in the fetal monitor strips was horrible, terrible negligence, and nothing to do with someone.
And so, should I back you up to the case that isn't here, that is the parents' case? Do you just posture this case that everybody can see? The parents,
do you believe so?
Have a cause of action. And it's your view that that is already well recognized in the state of Ohio.
And it helped by the government. Right. But this child's action for being born is not.
And now,
what a jury is going to do with a mother who stands up under oath and says, I want you to know what terminated this. And compare that to life, I don't know. I suspect what most juries would do. But my point is I'm very worried about creating a cause of action whereby people who are disabled will say, you know, I don't like the way I am. I have one arm, I got one leg, I got my ears are off or something. Let's go back and see if the doctor could have done something by test and found out that would happen would have warded me any better. I don't think that makes any sense. I don't think that's something we'd want to. We like liberty, pursuit of happiness are three principles we live by.
To follow up on what Justice Pfeiffer just asked you, however, you say the parents have the cause of action here, and I forget the jury and the trauma that that's going to go through. Wouldn't you say, other than the fact that Johnson held, and we were very careful to say, a healthy child, wouldn't Johnson be the answer that there would be no cause of action to what Justice Pfeiffer just said? Wouldn't you be here defending on Johnson, saying no cause of action for wrongful life?
I would be, probably.
Uh-huh. So when you said to him that the parents would have a cause of action, that's not entirely clear,
no,
is it?
I agree. I don't know. Like, this strikes me as such an obtuse, strange set of facts and circumstances relative to this case that I I just think it strikes in such opposition to what we traditionally believe in this country, is what is violent, and I believe it just cannot be created.
And that really is the underlying rationale of Johnson. You cannot show that the birth of a healthy child is damage.
And the flip side of the coin in this case is the only way they could have been prevented is to terminate. So we're talking about being born.
We're really talking, other justices have pointed out, I think part of our difficulty is we're putting upon nomenclature. There is no good nomenclature for what went wrong here, but something terrible did go wrong. It has foreseeable consequences.
Well,
and foreseeable damages, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I don't want to sound harsh or cold or whatever, but
maybe it's a loss of a choice, really.
It's a loss of a right, maybe someone could say. Something happens every day, unfortunately. Talk about harsh reality. The Johnson defects and brain damage.
I understand that, but
it's very difficult.
This goes one step beyond. The test was done, and the incorrect result was in place.
No question, but the foreseeability that Mr. Osh is talking about, I don't quite understand that. There's no foreseeability here. The only foreseeability is if you take the term, it's going to be probability be a born child. There's no foreseeable on the part of the doctor to foresee that if I don't tell her, she's going to abort it. That's hardly foreseeable on the part of the physician. It's the only duty is to bring light to this one.
I thought she had told him that, but that's why she was having the test.
I don't believe that's
what. You're saying that doctors perform this test to determine whether or not there are potentially grave abnormalities for the fetus. Don't foresee that if the report back is the test was bad, the test was bad, there are grave abnormalities, but the next step is the push.
I think that it's in each and every case, Your Honor. I don't believe the physician that entered
foreseeable.
I don't believe they entered that contract with the patients. That's not part of the obstetrician's duty. Now, they may consult, they may, but in each individual case, but it's foreseeable that you may find defects, but it's not foreseeable in globally that every parent is going to terminate the child.
But why would you have the test if you weren't going to do something about it? That would be the reason, just to know that you're going to have a child that's going to have
everybody has their own philosophical reasons why they do things, everybody has their own approach to this in pregnancy, and I don't think everybody terminates their pregnancies. I don't know. I can't make that judgment.
Some parents who have a test, when they have a plan, would be extraordinary that if they don't
have a test. Yeah, that could be, and what I'm saying is the foreseeability here. We're making a huge leap by saying that the obstetrician, by being negligent in communicating this information, knows in every case and said that he's now exempted the termination of the child. This is not his
fault. He knows he's prevented the choice.
He has prevented the information being disseminated for a choice. Now remember, because it's all about the obstetrician's had a duty to inform, et cetera, et cetera. That's a duty. But again, I wanted to emphasize that we're talking about the only way we have alleviated this was to terminate. And I can't imagine us standing in front of this court 10 years from now with this child saying, you know, I'd rather be dead, accepting that as something we can live by and stay alive.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much.
Just meaning to say, Mr. Wolfe, you've used your time to start with 30 seconds.
Same principle.
You want to try to answer the question that I've raised to Ms. Combs about the child is obviously a minor. The parents are here saying we want damages for when the child becomes a majority age. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Why do we not, I guess Justice Piper maybe asked this earlier, why do we not wait for the child to say whether the child believes he's been damaged by being born, even given these severe disabilities?
because the parents are standing in the child's shoes and bringing this as an adult parent to the next parent. I submit, Your Honor, at any time a child is injured under that theory, would it be better to wait until the child turns age majority? And under the law, the parents have the right, when that child has been injured, to bring a cause of action on behalf of that child to seek the compensation for that child, which is what we've done here.
You're obviously stated the law correctly, but it seems to me when it's a matter of life or death that perhaps there ought to be a different rule.
Well, and I say it goes back to the very initial premise, which was why we're before the court, is there in fact a cause of action by the child? Whether it's when the child turns 18, whether it's today when the child is 6, and that's good to the answer is yes. And I know I've used 30 seconds, but I just... very quickly.
No, you can continue.
Thank you. Justice Douglas, I think, and Justice Stratton really brought up the point, isn't this a straight, simply a straight negligence case of duty, breach of duty, causation, damage? Absolutely. That's what planning entailed. Planning is that you can call this whatever you want to call it, but what we're here about is a basic medical negligence tort.
Okay, but that's tort definition. Shows duty owed to a particular person.
Yes, sir.
Wasn't the duty owed to the parents, not to the child?
No, sir.
Because the child, you know, some of us believe that it's a child at conception, and some believe not until you hear the first cry.
Right.
In effect, the child was not born when the damage was incurred, the alleged damage was incurred, and therefore, the doctor didn't owe a duty to the child.
No, Your Honor, I respect to disagree with that. The doctor did owe a duty to the child, and I think the amicus brief filed by the High Academy of Trial Lawyer addressed that.
Yeah, it does.
The ACOG standards is clearly establishing, according to ACOG, the College of Obstetrician and Gynecologist, a duty is owed not only to the parent, but the child. And as I submit, Your Honor, the harsh reality, like it or not, this child was born with these significant defects and will incur those extraordinary expenses. This one last point, Ms. Coe's raised, you know, about the pain of suffering. I submit, as this court held Johnson, the normal cost and pain and suffering associated with raising a healthy child is not why we're here. But Your Honor's raising of a child that's fine to live enough goes above and beyond that as far as pain and suffering that the parents can incur. And it's those extraordinary expenses we are seeking this court to allow us to recover.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.